Hello, everyone. My name is Stephen Downs. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. Today I'm calling from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, where I've spent the last couple of days painting my house. So it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today about the subject of personal learning strategies. I will be, no veo nada. What does that mean? I'm not seeing anything, or I'm not hearing anything. I'm not sure. The slides are not shown yet. You should only be seeing my face at the moment. So I will be showing slides as well. Oh, screen is black. Why would the screen be black? That's sort of weird. You should be able to see my face. Please show the presentation. Okay, so here comes the presentation then. So you should be able to see this okay. The subject of today's presentation is strategies for personal learning. So you'll at least be able to see the presentation slides. I don't know why you were not able to see my video. I can see my video perfectly. But such is life on the internet. So what I want to talk to you about today, as the title suggests, it's personal learning. But I also want to talk about strategies for personal learning. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to first begin by talking about what I mean by personal learning. And then following that, I'll talk about three major types of strategies to pursue personal learning. And my approach will be to talk about personal learning for yourself, how to support your own personal learning, because that's where I always consider it best to begin. But if you're in a teaching position or advising teachers or in any sort of instructional position, these strategies apply equally well to the students and to the learners who you are responsible for. So let's begin by looking at personalization and personal learning. And, you know, the typical thing that people talk about is personalization. You've probably seen that a lot in the media. And basically the story they tell is that you create a personalized education plan, maybe with a teacher, that has very specific learning outcomes, and it's based on the competencies or goals you are trying to reach. And then the personalized learning system will use adaptive learning techniques where it will assess you from time to time, usually by some sort of online quiz or automatically graded assignment, where it determines whether or not you've achieved the current competency in a stream of competencies leading towards your learning objective. And the idea here is that it's mastery learning. You progress one competency after another until you reach your goal. And the teacher isn't the person who actually teaches you. The computer system teaches you. But the teacher orchestrates the whole process and maybe offers mentoring or something like that. That's the traditional view of personalized learning, and there are a lot of systems out there now that support this. Learning management systems support this. Tools like Newton support this. But that's not what I'm talking about. So what is it that I'm talking about? Let's consider two approaches. Let's consider one approach, which begins from the perspective of content, as compared to another approach which begins from the perspective of practice. The content-based approach is the approach that I've just talked about. It's the approach that sets certain learning goals, certain competencies that you are trying to achieve, and maps out a route to that goal. It's content-based because typically when you have a goal of achieving certain content, that goal is to remember a certain body of content. And you will prove your content through some sort of practice, like taking a test, like I just said. Compare that to a different approach, where in this case, the approach begins with practice. Now, what do I mean by that? Practice might be, for example, attempting to solve a problem. Maybe you're a programmer and you're attempting to solve a programming task. Or perhaps, like me, you're painting your house and you discover you need to make some small repairs and you need to discover how to make those repairs. Or maybe you're just doing some sort of hobby, you're learning a game or how to play an instrument, and you pick up the instrument and you start trying to play it. So in these cases, what's happening is you're beginning with some sort of thing that you are doing, and this will produce some sort of content. This will produce some sort of result from your practice. So, okay, we have these two approaches. Let's look at them in a bit more detail. The content-based approach defines an ideal state that you're trying to live up to. And that's the end goal. That's the final competency. That's the learning objective. Compared to the practice-based approach defines a desired state that you are attempting to achieve. This is not a learning goal, but it's a goal where you're trying to, as I said, solve some problem, meet some objective, do some task. In the ideal state, you attempt to learn your content, and then you do a test or assignment, and you are being tested by your instructor, or tested by the learning system. It's a test-based approach because it is matching you against this ideal that you're trying to achieve. As compared to with the practice-based approach, you are producing the results of an effort. You want to paint the house, you try to paint the house. And then the learning system or your teacher or whatever you're using tries to help you achieve a better result. You see the difference, right? In the one case, in the content-based approach, your teacher functions very much as an evaluator. In the practice-based approach, your teacher functions very much as a coach. So the process of learning is different in each of these two cases. In the content-based approach, each iteration will be a case of correction. You tried something, you did some practice, you made some mistakes, you must be corrected. And the degree of that correction is identified as a gap between what you know and what the ideal state is. Compare that to the practice-based approach, where each iteration is an opportunity to try again. So it's not a case of continual failure until you achieve an ideal state. Rather, it's a case of continuous success and iteration and opportunity as you build on your skills toward your desired state. Now, the learning metaphor, if I can use that term, is very different in the two cases. In the case of the content-based approach, the metaphor is that of a library. Your course is like a book, and the lessons are like chapters in the book. And you move through the book in a sequential process. You go through requirements, one requirement after another requirement after another requirement. And gradually, you reduce your errors as you move toward an ideal state. Of course, you can never reach the ideal state. Nobody has ever learned perfectly. Compared to the practice-based approach, where it is like you are in an environment, an arena perhaps, a laboratory, your workshop, your house, if you're painting your house. Your environment creates affordances. That is to say, it creates opportunities for you to practice something. Each environment offers different affordances. And learning design here is like building an environment where we build in the affordances. So if I was designing an environment to help you learn how to paint, I would design an environment with clean surfaces, with a supply of paint, and some sort of objective that you're trying to achieve as a result, for example, a nicely painted house, or a painting of a picture, or whatever it is you wanted to paint. See the difference? The approach that is content-based is personalized. The approach that is practice-based is personal. These are really very different at heart, and I've tried to capture that with the two slogans. In personalized learning, we do something for you. In personal learning, you do something for yourself. Think about the process of learning in personalized learning. The content is being set. The objectives are being created for you. All of the tests are created for you. Your responsibility is simply to fit into the system and produce the required output, gradually being corrected to reduce your gaps. In personal learning, by contrast, you actually manage every aspect of your own learning. You determine what the desired state is, what project you're trying to accomplish, what problem you're trying to solve. You undertake to practice. Yes, you will be helped, you will be supported, you will be given advice, but you will not be told what to do. And then each iteration, you see your own improvement and you define for yourself when you've achieved the desired state. So that's personal versus personalized learning. And it is a concept that you know well, I think, already. It's a concept that you've seen in other environments. In healthcare, for example, we can think of personalized healthcare, which is like your own room in the hospital and a doctor who's assigned to you and addresses your particular medical needs, as compared to personal healthcare, where you manage your own health, you keep your own statistics, you decide what things you are going to do, whether you exercise or you eat well or whatever, to maintain a healthy state. Think of Well, I sometimes use, and I don't know if the example translates into Spanish, but I sometimes use phrases like chocolate versus chocolatized. Chocolate is like personal. It's real. It is the actual thing. Chocolatized is something that was mass-produced and then shaped in order to imitate something that is real. So the difference between personal and personalized sometimes can be cast into the perspective of real learning, which is personalized learning, and artificial or manufactured learning, which is personalized learning. And I think there's a point to that. You know, Paulo Freire talks about learning as being something that is not simply the acquisition of content that you would store in yourself as though it were money you store in a bank, but it is the creation of personal capacities and personal empowerment by recognizing and understanding the environment in which you work and the problems you are trying to solve and the quality of life that you are seeking to achieve. So my preference is toward personalized learning. And I'm just going to stop the share here for a second and see if the video... Oh, you can't start your video because the host has stopped it. Okay, so that's probably why you were seeing black before and you're seeing black now, because the host blocked the video. So I'll go back to sharing the screen then. And unless the host has unblocked the video. No, I think I'm still being blocked, but I don't know. Yes, I'm still being blocked. So back to sharing the screen then. I'll see if I can't find... There we go. I believe that's the right screen. So, okay. This leads to what I've taken to calling recently the inflexible law of learning. And as people have reminded me in the past, you know, this is, of course, nothing new. But, you know, when we look at the development of learning technology, we seem to spend most of our efforts ignoring it. So here's the law. It is when we do stuff that we learn, not when stuff does something for us. You know, there's this perspective out there that if only we could find the right content, if only we could find the right learning algorithm, if only we could create the right learning management system, then the problem of learning would be solved because people would be receiving exactly the right resources. And I've never believed that. Oh, sure, it's useful to find the right resources. Don't get me wrong about this. Finding the resource that you need is the difference between being able to repair an engine and not being able to repair an engine. But the learning takes place when you actually try to repair the engine and not by watching a video about repairing an engine. It's when you do stuff that you learn. And this is the core behind the thinking of personal learning as opposed to personalized learning. In the case of personalized learning, all the effort is spent trying to do stuff for the learner. In the case of personal learning, all the effort is spent creating the environment where a person can do stuff. Okay, so now this is going to take us to the three major strategies for supporting personal learning. I could have picked these out of the air. In fact, I've picked them from Dutton. And, you know, there are many ways of saying the same sort of thing. So what I've done here is I've simply borrowed a frame that someone else has created in order to set this up. But it's a good frame, and it helps us get to our objective. So here are the three strategies: sharing, contributing, and co-creating. And each of them adds an aspect of what it means to do something in order to learn. So I'm going to look at these each one by one and go through them and talk about what I understand by them. So let's look first at the idea of sharing. So let's get our technology right. Let's get our environment right. You remember I talked before about content versus practice. Now I want to distinguish between two models of learning. One, again, which is based on content, and the other, which is based on networks. And the content model we've already seen. It is the model of traditional education. It is the model of standard education outcomes. It is the model based on courses and classes. And then somewhere along the line, as we've created online learning, we've gone beyond just the content of a course and begun to engage with each other, begun to have conversations with each other, begun to form communities. And we've seen that in the literature, things like Etienne Wenger's Communities of Practice, for example. And we've seen that in our own world, as we've seen even learning management systems now, including things like discussion boards and chat areas. There's a chat area in this in application. I can't see it when I'm playing the when I'm playing the slides, but there is one. But gradually, as we engage, our courses resemble books less and less. They resemble content less and less. And they begin to look like networks. They begin to look like environments where each one of us is a dot that is connected to a bunch of other dots. We are a person in a course, and we communicate with and engage with other people in that course. And so the practice of learning begins to change from a practice that is based on remembering content to a practice that is based on being a part of a network and sharing within that network. You know, it's this whole idea of having a voice, this whole idea of making choices. And I've borrowed a bit here from Barbara Bray and Kathleen McClaskey, where they actually talk about increasing voice over time or increasing choice over time. Now, I'm a little skeptical of a hierarchy of these things, but I still think that they capture some important concepts. Looking at increasing voice, for example, you can go from expression of an opinion to consultation with another person about some problem or challenge to participating in a community, and then they go from partnership to activism to leadership. I think any of those is perfectly acceptable, and I think any of those can be completely learner-driven or completely teacher-driven. What I think is important is to understand that these are all ways of sharing. The other way of sharing is to make choices in an environment. And that might seem a bit counterintuitive, but if you've ever been walking in a crowd of people and you reach a corner and, you know, maybe it's the entrance to a football game, or maybe it's coming through the corridors at an airport, and you're there in the corridor and there are two routes you can choose, and you choose one, you find other people see that choice and make their own decisions based on what they've seen. Choosing things is a way of sharing. So participating, designing, advocating, making, all of these as well are ways in which we choose, and all of these choices are ways in which we share with others. You know, it's about learning through practice. Learning through doing things and then sharing these things that we do. Whether we play music, whether we work with electronics and share the results of that. Any sort of practice that we do in a community of people is a way of sharing. It's a type of exploring. Here I am sharing my trip that I took through San Diego one day. And on the left-hand side, you can see the route that I took on a bicycle from a hotel along the waterfront, across the peninsula to the cliffs, and then back climbing up a hill with a bicycle. And on the right, I'm sharing a photograph of the hill that I climbed carrying a bicycle. And so this is me sharing my experience. And this is useful for others because not by creating content, right? It's not about I've given other people a route that they can follow, or perhaps warned them, don't go this way because you'll have to climb a hill with your bicycle. But I've given them options, choices, an example of the sort of thing that can be done. It's like reading like a scientist. When you read like a scientist, you don't just absorb the content. Rather, you analyze, think, and actually attempt to replicate what you've read. So reading like a scientist, you're looking at the context, what the problem is that they're trying to solve, who it is that's trying to solve it. You're looking at the results, what they call here the impersonal subtext, how the answers to the question will change my life or others. And you're looking at the thought or the experiment that can solve the problem. Reading like a scientist means you are thinking about how you could do the same thing and share it with others and make the meaning of what you've read clear to other people. Anytime I read an article, as you know, I have my own personal newsletter, I'm always reading the article from the perspective of how could I present this article to other people in a clear and relatively short post, so that I can really draw out what the article is saying and why the article is important. So that's the first, sharing. It's almost like thinking out loud or working out loud, doing your job in such a way that you are thinking about how to expose that to other people. But now we want to make this process a little bit more active and a little bit more explicit. So we move into the next part of supporting personal learning, contributing. And this is now the actual process that we will undertake in order to support personal learning. The model for this process is the MOOC. Now, most people by now have already heard the background to this. George Siemens and I created an online course. We structured the course in the form of a network. Just like I've described in this talk, we moved away from the idea that we are trying to create content and moved toward the idea that we're trying to build a network. And so what we tried to do was create an environment where people could share their experiences, their discoveries, and their contributions with other people in the course. And this became very popular in a hurry. And the structure of what we were doing made it possible for us to support hundreds and hundreds of people. And that became the massive open online course. So what we discovered in the massive open online course was a general mechanism that people could employ in order to participate in this course. It was an explicit form of contributing to the course. The first part was aggregation. And as the slide says, each person in the course creates their own perspective on the material by selecting what seems important to them. This is very different from traditional learning, where what you will study or what you will read is selected by the course instructor or by the institution. Oh, sure. The instructor or the institution might have some recommendations, but that's only a starting point. And the objective is to choose materials from the wider web that will be relevant and useful to other people. And the idea here is that each participant in the course, by making this set of choices, is revealing to other people in the course a particular perspective on the materials. So that's the first step. The second step is remixing. I always think of Prince when I think of remixing. What we are doing here is taking the idea of all the contributions that have been gathered by all the people in the course and shared with everybody else in the course, and we select from those materials and we bring them together. Back in the early days of Web 2.0, this used to be called a mashup, where we're taking a bit of one thing that was created and a bit of another thing that was created and creating a new thing out of those things. Remixing has been the source of all kinds of internet memes. It's been the source of things like lolcats, where they take a picture of a cat, add some text to that, some social context to that. The idea here is that what we're trying to do is take these different perspectives and create something new by blending them together. Kind of like Tex-Mex food. The third step is adaptation or repurposing. Because again, learning is a lot more than simply receiving content and filtering content. Learning is about creating something new out of the content. So when we take the stuff that other people have shared with us and we remix it, we consider our own perspective, we now add our own voice to this. We add our own perspective, our own reworking or revising or interpreting or translating, or as I say sometimes, folding, spindling, and mutilating of the content to make something new, something that is our own unique voice. This is something I learned very early on when I was blogging. And you might think, well, how does that fit here? When I was blogging, I would read articles from many different people. And a big part of what I did was to, you know, select the content and aggregate the content and share it and sometimes remix it into a single post. But gradually, as I read a lot of content and brought my own perspective to it, I'd be creating my own articles with my own arguments, my own perspectives and point of views. And it's always built on the remix from other people's work. It's, you know, when you blog, when you write a post, it's virtually impossible to simply write a post out of nothing. But once I have this basic framework, then I have something I can build on and add my own content to. And if you think about it, this really is exactly the same as the essay writing process in a typical school, except they're very focused on content and structure and not on what you're actually doing. But really, if you think about it, if you're writing in history or geography or philosophy or whatever, you're bringing in materials from different sources, hopefully not just what the teacher recommended to you. You blend them together and create a particular perspective from the mashup, and then you add your own interpretation, your own flavor to it. You create something new, which is your own essay, with your own point of view, with your own argument. And then finally, the last step is feeding it forward, publishing it, sharing it with people beyond your immediate learning environment. In my case, it was always posting it on my newsletter, posting it on my website or in my blog. If it's photographs, posting them on Flickr. If it's videos, posting them on YouTube or Vimeo. I used to use Blip, but Blip disappeared. It's hard to share. Well, it's easy to share. You just push a button frequently, you know, copy and paste the text into Blogger and push a button. But it's hard to share because you're putting your content out there. Your content will be evaluated. It will be criticized, or worse, it might be ignored. That's the risk you take. And it is always a risk. And it's not just content. Remember, back at the beginning, I talked about personal learning as solving a problem or undergoing a project. Feeding forward is sharing your solution to that problem or your version of the project. If you paint a painting, show people the painting. If you write a tune, share the tune with other people, play it for people. If you paint a house, show people the house. It's hard to share, but it's better to share. And it's better to share because it adds to the motivation that you had. You're probably already motivated because you've selected the content for yourself. But now you're even doubly motivated because you're sharing it with other people. And because the motivation is there, you will pay more attention to the details, more attention to the sorts of criticisms that people might raise. You're looking at what you're creating from a variety of perspectives by imagining yourself in the shoes of other people looking at what you've built. And so sharing in public gives you that perspective you might not have if you're sharing only with yourself or only with yourself and your teacher or a small number of classmates. So that's the second step, and that's the process involved in creating a MOOC and participating in a MOOC. The third part is co-creating. And this part becomes interesting because it's not really different from the other two parts. It's like, you know, the first part was sharing, and then the second part was contributing. And sharing is a lot like contributing, except, you know, it's a bit more purposeful to contribute. Now we're going beyond contributing, but it's still the same thing, really. But co-creating is a bit more purposeful than contributing. But what is co-creating? You notice I'm using co-creating and not collaborating. I draw a very strong distinction between, on the one hand, cooperation, and on the other hand, collaboration. collaboration is a content-based strategy. Collaboration is a case where somebody else determines the outcome or the objective, and everybody works toward that outcome or objective. In cooperation, each person has their own objective, their own project, their own thing that they are trying to do. And they are working together because they find a mutual advantage in working together, even if they are not all working on the same thing. But very often, the result of cooperation, the result of working together, is that they co-create something. And this is a town on an island in the Mediterranean that you see in the picture here. And each one of those houses, each one of those buildings was built by a different person with a different purpose in mind. They share an environment, and so in a certain sense, they share resources. They share the same roads, they share the same power system and water system. So they're co-creating something here. And of course, they're co-creating a town. But none of the individuals is working on creating a town. And it's not like they've collaborated with the purpose of creating a town. Rather, the town is what results as a consequence of them all working together and practicing and addressing their own projects and their own problems in a common environment. Cindy Moss, speaking just last week, in fact, at Discovery Education Network, said that STEM, which stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, is a culture. Now, what she meant by that is that learning a discipline like science, technology, engineering, or math is very much the same as building a house in a town, in the sense that you're working on your own objectives, but you're participating in a community where a lot of what you are doing will be informed by the norms, the values, and the customs of the community. To learn how to build a house is the same as to learn physics, is the same as to learn mathematics. And it is to enter into an enterprise in an environment with a community. And it is through immersion in that environment that you acquire that knowledge, that capacity, which is made manifest by the solving of problems and the completion of projects, such as the house that you are trying to build, such as the solving of a mathematical theorem, such as the discovery of a new principle of physics. This is not a new observation. It's an observation that has been made by people like Larry Loudon, who wrote about progress and its problems, by people like Thomas Kuhn in the 1970s, who wrote about paradigms in science, where a paradigm in science is a shared set of problems, a shared vocabulary or way of talking about those problems, and even sort of a common understanding of what counts as evidence and what counts as a solution for a problem. It's not shared in the sense of collaboration, but it's shared in the sense of an environment where each person has their own perspective and their own take on that environment. So learning is immersion into a culture, creating something in that culture, solving problems in that culture. And that's where we get co-creating from. learning within that culture is, as I say, a form of recognition. Or another way of saying it is, learning is a way of seeing, as Wittgenstein might say. And it's something that grows and evolves into a set of basic literacies in that environment. So that when you've learned something, through this process of co-creating, you begin to see and think about and talk about the world in a certain way. And it's this way that nobody has actually explicitly taught you as content, but rather it's this way of seeing the world that that comes to being as a result of your interactions with each other. It's something new over and above the content. Nobody can teach you how to see the world the way a physicist does. The only way to learn how to see the world that way is to actually do physics. And over time, trying to solve the problems of physics and working with other people in the community, it becomes natural, like speaking, like seeing, like hearing. And so we get the learning communities, the MOOCs. And we get things like hackathons, where people get together in a room and try to solve problems with technology, for example. We get things like the EduCamp, which is a process where you move from one table to another table, and you're actually playing with particular technologies, trying them out for yourself, talking about them with friends, and again, trying to see what sort of perspective you can bring to these technologies, what sorts of problems you could solve with these technologies, where there's no curriculum, but rather an environment where there are opportunities and affordances for you to choose your own goals and define for yourself what is success. It's things like STEM Camp. STEM Camp is an environment, again, and you bring, in this case, children into the environment, and they solve problems, whether indoors, working with models and new technology, or outdoors, learning to navigate in a forest, or learning to identify plants in a forest. How would you survive in a forest? These are the sorts of questions that STEM Camp answers. And again, it's putting yourself in that environment and solving problems in that environment. And as a result of that, a new understanding of that environment is created that allows you to see it and see the problems in it from a certain perspective. And that really is how knowing by doing comes into being. That really is what personal learning is. And that really is the strategy to support personal learning. By creating environments where you can immerse yourself into the day-to-day activities and the culture of someone or of people who already know about this. I've often said, the best place to learn forestry is in a forest. The best place to learn physics is in a lab. The best place to learn law is in the courtroom. And by being in this environment, solving problems in this environment, talking with people in this environment, sharing, contributing, you become part of the creation of new knowledge that over time you gradually become aware of. So that's my talk. You can find my stuff at www.downs.ca. And I'm sorry the video didn't work, but I hope you enjoyed the slides nonetheless. Thank you. And it still won't let me show the video. So we're just waiting to see if there are any questions. And that's a really good question. And it depends a lot on what you're trying to do. So there's no one way of creating an environment. But what you're trying to do is to create a place where people can exercise choices, make decisions, and build something. So you need to create mechanisms for each of those three things. If you're building it in software, for example, you would want to build an environment where each individual is, if you will, an object in that environment, presented with a number of choices that they could make, and presented with the opportunity to create something and share something. A good example of this is an online game, for example, World of Warcraft or EVE Online. And these games function as large social environments where individual players can communicate with each other, they can explore the environment, and they can build things in the environment. In World of Warcraft, they can build cities or communities. In EVE, they can build spaceships. And they're presented with challenges in these environments, usually created by other players. So there might be battles. There might be quests to solve. In the original multi-user dungeons, there were always quests to be solved. And the key point here is to preserve the properties that make the environment worth exploring. So you know, I've divided them into a group of fairly important criteria, but it depends on the environment. But the first criteria is the individual players have to be autonomous. They have to be making their own decisions. If they're being led around on a guided tour, then they're not making decisions and the environment isn't good. There has to be diversity. The environment needs to change. They need to be presented with different problems, different opportunities. It's ideal if they're in an environment where there are other players because other players bring about a chaotic element, an unexpected element, different perspectives and choices and points of view. It should be an open environment in the sense that although it presents problems to solve and ways of creating things, you're not limited in what you can do to solve those problems. I'll give you an example. EVE Online is an environment where people try to conquer planets and mine them for resources. But what happens in EVE is that as much of the interactivity takes place outside the game as inside the game, as people form alliances and make plans and have communications, etc. So EVE is open in that way. It's open in that things that happen outside the game can influence what happens inside the game. And things that happen inside the game can influence things that happen outside the game. In a learning environment, the same sort of thing should apply. A learning environment should be able to have some kind of impact in the real world. And I've always encouraged the creation of environments to solve real world problems and present them to the actual people involved in that sort of thing. NASA is really good at this. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the United States, by inviting students to propose experiments that will actually be flown on, well, it used to be the space shuttle, but will actually be flown now to the International Space Station. So an educational event becomes a real event. And then the final thing is interactivity, where the environment should support the possibility of participants defining something that is greater than the environment itself. And again, online games are really good at this because they often create an environment with choices and challenges, but the things that get created inside the game, you know, maybe tribes or nations or cultural things, the internet is full of cultural things, memes and so on, that become more than just what was taught. So creating technology, whether it's online or offline, that preserves those four principles are, in my way, in my opinion, the strategy that you would take in order to build one of those environments. So we see, how can learning by doing be developed to its full potential within the full environment? Is it best in motivation, information, connection, networking, or what? So, So, looking at the second part of that, where is it best? I mean, if I had to trace that right down to its roots, which the question sort of forces me to do, I'd say that it's in the area of motivation that it is most significant. When people are solving their own problems, meeting their own challenges, defining their own objectives, they are already motivated. You do not need to motivate them. And indeed, what we've seen in the history of the internet is people who are motivated will manage with very poor learning environments in order to achieve results. You know, I've seen people learn using email courses, and they would never learn on an email course unless they were motivated, but they were motivated and they were creating their own solutions. So I think that's where it begins. I think it begins with motivation. It begins by addressing real problems for real people. And then the next part is the connection and networking part. And this part reflects what Terry Anderson calls presence. The idea that there is somebody at the other end of the line who's knowledgeable, sympathetic, interested, maybe concerned. The idea that you're doing something with a real person who is aware and comprehending of what you are doing. And Anderson talks about different kinds of presence, and presence that can be instantiated in a person or in a community or in an artifact. And all of these are legitimate forms of presence. So if we have motivation, you're motivated to do something. And presence, there are other people who are involved in this, who are engaged in this same thing with you. I think that you have the essential elements for learning right there. And anything else really is a bonus. We have another question. In this new model, how do I recommend to apply exams or tests to evaluate the knowledge acquired? Now remember, the whole concept of tests is a type of content-based learning. It's a type of personalized learning. So it's outside the domain that I'm talking about. Right? Remember that the idea of a test is to define an ideal content state that you're trying to memorize or something like that. So the question really is, how do you evaluate personal learning? What is the mechanism to evaluate it? And we're not going to begin with the presumption that it's tests. So I would say the first and foremost mechanism is, did you solve the problem you were trying to solve? Did you perform the task that you were attempting to perform? In personal learning, it's you deciding whether you were satisfied with the learning that you undertook. You're not trying to do it for some external third party. So suppose I was learning how to paint, and I look at what I painted and I say, did I learn to paint well enough that the result of my painting is satisfactory to me? And if the answer is yes, then great, I've learned how to paint. And you know, people are going to be honest about that sort of thing. They're not going to fool themselves. You know, did I learn how to play guitar online? A person might say, yes, I did learn, even if they're not very good, because they learned what they wanted to learn. But nobody who wanted to be a good guitar player is going to listen to themselves play badly and then say, well, yeah, I really did learn it. That's not going to happen. It's like the old saying goes, you are your own harshest critic. So I think that's the first answer to the question. The second answer to the question comes in the sharing and the feeding forward. And that answer is answered by considering, are you able to contribute to the community in a meaningful way? Are you able to solve community problems? Are you able to add to the knowledge of the community? Do other people in the community recognize your contributions? So there's a long story here to be told about what mechanisms we would use in order to determine this. And I've written about this elsewhere. But I think that's the second part. The community-based evaluation is based on your participation in the community and your place in the network. We have, continuing, what about the feedback of the different ways that you presented? So, and I think that this is the community evaluation that I'm talking about. When you share, the question is, did people find what you shared worth sharing? You know, did they actually read what you wrote? When you contribute, was what you contributed used by the community to build something to add to the community as a whole? And when you co-created, have you been a part of the creation and resulted in becoming part of the community that co-created whatever it was that was created? So it's very much an immersion-based mechanism of evaluation. If you have successfully integrated yourself into that community, you have successfully learned. Thank you. Sounds like we're done. So that's all the questions that I have. So I'd like to thank all of you. Thank you. All right. I'd appreciate that.